Yaffe lifts a finger, and a mouse is there, puts his hands together, and a seagull takes the air. Yaffe lifts a finger, and a scampi darts about. Yaffe bends another, and a tortoise head peeps out. These hands were made for making, and making they must do.
Hey, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 154 of the Diddly Dum Podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
So, I think we want to start, gentlemen, by paying tribute to someone who we sadly lost since last we recorded an episode, and that was the great Rick Jones, better known as Yaffe, the Finger Bobs Man. Now, I suspect this will mean nothing to you, Hayden, will it?
Finger bobs.
He wasn't on a shiny cartoon where he kept shooting people with lasers.
Okay, was it a program where a guy made little cardboard animals and then stuck his fingers in them and then sort of played? Sorry, that genuinely came out really wrong.
Yes, that makes it sound much more sophisticated, Hayden.
Was it made in the 70s, I guess, with that kind of stuff going on? Was he a bald man with a beard?
Yes.
Right. I've seen some pictures online on the Twitters, yeah.
Just you to put the finger in Finger Bob's, Hayden. Yes. I don't know about you, Mark.
Yes, I do remember watching Finger Bob's, but I don't remember a lot about it. Although I do get quite a nice pang of nostalgia when I've been watching the clips of him that have been on various places since he passed away.
Is he the bloke who used to sort of jump around in the forest with a long scraggly beard?
Is that the one I'm thinking of?
Hang on, I'm going to have to consult the museum computer while you two are talking amongst yourselves.
Cat Weasel!
Yes, it was, sorry. God's sakes.
Born in Ontario, which I suppose makes him Canada's greatest contribution to broadcasting. Oh dear, you think you know everything, don't you? Many years later, he revealed the scale of marijuana use on Play School after Johnny Ball alleged that he and another presenter were stoned out of their minds while filming a nativity scene in the 1970s.
Fantastic.
Speaking in 2012, Rick Jones told The Sun that the BBC was really liberal at the time, explaining, "Once you were in, all laws were forgotten. I had a wonderful time. Marijuana was like cornflakes."
Oh, we can believe that, can't we, at the BBC in the 70s? God, all laws were forgotten.
Mark?
Yes?
Which shape window do you want to fly out of?
Oh, I'll go through the round window.
having been fired by the BBC, after a fan sent him two cannabis spliffs at the corporation's address. Jones had success as a musician, fronting the British country rock band Meal Ticket. I've not heard of that.
I'll tell you what, the writer of this article clearly has never done drugs, because a cannabis spliff... Allegedly, a spliff is just cannabis, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I guess...
I've no idea, is it?
Well, neither would I, Doc. That's why I'm asking the grown-ups in the room.
Only we had an expert to handle.
Yes.
Yaffe lifts two fingers, and a spliff is there. Yoffy lights another. And Mary Jane fills the air.
I also noticed while I was researching that the instrumental music at the beginning and the end of the Finger Pops music is clearly where Final Fantasy VII stole their Cosmo Canyon background music from, because they're almost identical. And on the subject of people stealing things, have any of you seen the new long-awaited-for trailer for the new Dune movie?
No.
Yes, I have, yeah.
Well, I was watching it the other day, and clearly this Frank Herbert guy, I don't know who he is, but he clearly stole most of his ideas from Chris Boucher's Robots of Death. What did you all think about the BBC deleting all of its social media accounts for a few days?
It was a bit odd, wasn't it? I mean, the thing I found, and this is the thing about echo chambers on social media, is that Doctor Who fans were up in arms, and most of my time feed, or whatever you want to call it, that was just full of people going, oh no, Doctor Who's accounts are all down, all across social media, what's happening? And then you actually look at, and someone said, oh my god, it's trending, and I looked at it, and there was like 2,000 tweets worldwide. So if it was a marketing ploy, it's only the kind of thing you could expect that would happen under a Chris Chibnall's regime, because it was crap.
I'm not sure if it was entirely a marketing thing, because they've kind of rebranded, haven't they? They changed their logo and they've changed all their things to Doctor Who the Flux. So,
yeah.
But I did wonder if it'd be inspired by Facebook's outage. And I wondered at the time if they'd gone like, oh, did you see that? Everyone was talking about Facebook, and Facebook was trending all over Twitter when it disappeared. I wonder what will happen if we do that with Doctor Who for 24 hours. But no, it didn't seem to work very well. It seemed to just make quite a lot of people angry for some reason.
Yes, didn't it?
I don't know why they were angry.
Doctor Who fans are always angry over something, though, aren't they? That's the...
It got me regularly checking BBC's Doctor Who accounts for the first time in memory, though, so...
Well, yeah, this is true. I mean, I haven't been on Twitter much, but I went on Twitter to have a look. I talk about their promotion. Did you see the phone line number that they put out? Did you ring that?
Yes. Yes, I did.
I actually thought that was quite a nice touch. I quite like that.
It's mainly the Doctor saying, oh, there's lots of aliens invading Earth. I don't know. I can't say it excited me. It's not sort of, you know, building up into any great...
You've reached the voicemail of...
The Doctor. If you're ringing this, it means enemies from across the universe have arrived on Earth, and the battle is coming imminently. Who did you see and where? I need as much information as possible. Protect yourself. It's coming. Be ready.
The flux. Is that another word for diarrhea?
Yeah, well, yes. Various things being emitted from the body, I think, isn't it? But it means sort of like a continuous change, doesn't it? So
yeah.
I wonder if this story is about somebody going back through the Doctor's past or something. I mean, who knows either.
Do you think, because we've only got 6 episodes this year, do you think that A, we're going to get a New Year's Day special, and B, do you think that the episodes will be longer to make up for the fact there's only 6 episodes?
That's it. Well, presumably they only did 6 episodes, because that's all they could make. If they're going to reduce it, I'm not sure there would be much point in them in making them longer. No, just... We just want to see what we see. It just seems to me to be this era. Anyone who regularly edits podcasts on using Audacity software will be familiar with the tool Fade Out. And I just realize that's what's happening. We'll see what happens. What were you going to say, Mark?
I was going to say that it's the 3 episodes next year that will be the special length ones, won't it?
Although this was an interestingly worded tweet as well that went out yesterday when we were recording, dear listeners. A picture of Jodie Whittaker and Mandip Gill with a clapperboard saying, "Big news, Jodie Whittaker and Mandip Gill have finished filming." And it's kind of like, okay, finished filming what? Do you mean finished filming the special, the regeneration episode? Has Mandip Gill finished filming completely? Like, because if that's the way to announce a companion's leaving, I feel as though, I mean, she may not have been to everyone's tastes. I mean, no companion is, of course. But that's shortchanging the actress a bit, isn't it? If that's how they're announcing, yes, she's leaving.
Yeah, they announced it on Radio 4 News, I think, later that night, that Jodie Whittaker had indeed finished recording her final scene as the Doctor. So that's it, yeah, that they finished, full stop. Also suggests, I guess, I mean, it's not definite, but it would suggest that Yaz is there all the way through now to the end. Also, I just noticed just earlier today, they've Doctor Who Flux account, the official one, has just released a small bit of footage saying, it's coming, be ready, Doctor Who Flux. And above it, they've written, trailer tomorrow? Question mark. So by the time this podcast comes out, there will have been another trailer tomorrow.
Have you seen the most recent trailer?
Yeah, yes. What is Dan doing with the TARDIS? He's just got, what's he
I
doing?
Don't know.
He's not trained. Get away from that console.
Listen carefully, we don't have much time. The Flux is coming. It's bringing with it the Sontarans, Weeping Angels, creatures known as the Ravagers, and enemies from across the universe. This is the fight of our lives.
Doctor, we need you!
I can't hold it much longer, Doctor! It's coming. Be ready.
They're coming. Sontarans, Weeping Angels, and creatures known as Cabbages.
My God, the budget has really hit Doctor Who this year.
I did wonder whether this is all suddenly an explanation for the Fourth Doctor's famous words. I could have a cabbage on my shoulder in this scene. Have we got any thoughts about these rumours that Sony is trying to take over Bad Wolf?
Oh, they have, haven't they?
That's another thing that seems to have provoked hysteria, isn't it? Where hysteria. Whereby you've got people saying, oh, this is Sony, they'll end up owning Doctor Who. If the BBC aren't careful, it's...
Yeah, I don't see that at all. I don't see how that would work, because no, the BBC will still own Doctor Who. It's just that Sony will be owning a company that are co-producing it. That's all it is. It's not...
I also don't see... They're saying this would be great because Sony could really hugely increase Bad Wolf's budget. But if the BBC, let's say the BBC is paying £1 million per episode to Bad Wolf to produce Doctor Who, if Sony gives them a £3 million budget to produce each episode, then they'll be £2 million out of pocket, won't they? It's not like, as far as I'm aware, the BBC haven't given Bad Wolf any rights to televise it.
No.
Either nationally or internationally. It's just effectively like, with most outsourcing, they're paying, it's like in our office block. At work, we used to have cleaners who were employed by us. Now we employ someone to, out and outside firm, send their cleaners in to clean the building. It's just another way of doing it, but this is a very strange way anyway. Any other stuff to talk about?
Yeah, one little thing. My sister went into the local B&M in one of the two B&Ms that we have in Canterbury.
Oh, yeah.
And
jammy.
To see if she could get me the Vord and the Sensorite sets for Christmas. And she went up to the manager who was there. He was walking around with his clipboard and his badge on. And she said to him, do you have the new Doctor Who figures in? And he looked at her and laughed, went, huh, you must be joking. He said, the day they were out, one guy came in and filled up a trolley with our entire stock and brought the lot. And my sister said, well, that seems a bit unfair. And the bloke just literally laughed at her and went, ha, yeah, like we care, we get the money. And I just thought, oh, bastards.
Wow.
Yeah. So, cheers. Thanks, B&M in Canterbury, one of you.
Thing is, the only way to stop it is just for everyone not to buy off these scammers. Mm. What are they called?
Scalpers.
Scalpers, sorry. And just let them have a big pile of all these boxes fester in their garden shed for years with no one wanting to buy it. It's the only way you'll stop people doing it.
Yeah.
But it's just, I just find that's unpleasant, that.
Yeah, me too.
Doctor Who fans are the worst, really, aren't they? Sorry, listeners, but we are, in a sense. It's just like what was happening with the Blu-ray collections. And of course, that's kind of been tempered by the looks of it by the release of the slipcases. But it's not like you can do that with the toys. The only way I'd work around it is to make these things available online. as well as in the shops, and then people can pre-order them, and then set a limit on the pre-order amount. So let's say, I don't know, 3 per person, if you want to buy for a couple of friends or whatever. That's probably the wisest way to go. But yeah, that's the world we live in today.
Yeah, it did give me the opportunity when my sister told me this to say, well, that's fine. Do you know what? Cancel those anyway, because season 17 is coming out in the limited edition box set Blu-ray, and I want that instead.
I thought you were going to say season 17 figures are coming out. So, well, it'll probably take those as well.
No. So I persuaded my sister to go online and pre-order the season 17 Blu-ray box set for me for Christmas. And I would rather have that than any other piece of Doctor Who merchandise at the moment, as it's one of the collections that I'm most excited about getting. I know that Hayden can't understand that at all, but...
I can never remember the numbers. What round do you watch 17 is?
17 will be Destiny of the Daleks up to...
City of... Oh, right.
Horns and Nymon, Sharda.
Oh, I see. Now we understand.
Yeah, you won't be surprised to learn that this is the first Blu-ray collection box set I haven't pre-ordered. I mean, I'm buying the slipcases anyway now going forward and selling the limited edition ones. But even then, I mean, I may wait until season 17 comes down in price, perhaps.
Are you suggesting it won't sell out immediately?
No. No, I know a lot of people enjoy season 17, but it isn't, as you all well know, it's not one of my favourites. But I have to say, the best bit about it for me is the fact that you're finally getting that animated version of Sharda in 6 parts. Yay. Not like an epic film, which was just a stupid idea anyway, to be honest with you. Yeah. Who does it? Why do that? I mean, like, no other animations come out and be like, It's like saying Dalek's Master Plan. Oh, yeah, let's make that into one big film. It's like, Christ, you need about 4 intermissions in that thing. I've got the Sharda version from 2017 where there are no credits and it's just one long film. And it bored the arse off me after about 45 minutes because there's just no break. So it'll be really interesting to see that, as it should have been, as it went out and all the rest of it. Funnily enough, actually, last weekend, we actually went on a little bit of the Sharda location tour in Cambridge, myself, ooh, William and Sophie.
Oh, yes, you're saying. Tell us more, Hayden.
Well, we went to Cambridge.
Did you take William out of his pram and stick him under that fence?
So what we... No, what I did instead was I made him... bearing in mind he's only 6 months old, made him punt us along the river. Whilst recounting the names of famous scholars who have attended Cambridge over the years. Interestingly enough, Portugal Place, which is one of the streets that Tom Baker rides his bicycle down when he's being chased by the Ball of Skagora, which would have been a much better title and very misleading title for the story, is that they've now put a sign up saying no cycling.
Oh.
So I quite like that. I noticed that. That was the first change this time. But apart from bunging William under a fence, coincidentally, I haven't actually seen my son since then because they won't let me anywhere near him. But here we are.
They're selling for £35 on eBay.
What is?
These Keys of Marinus and Ian sets.
Oh, yeah.
So how much are they in the shop?
£19.99.
Bloody hell.
Can I just say, Amazon, as a word of warning to everyone, have been mucking up the pre-orders for all the Blu-rays, so I wouldn't go to them for any Doctor Who merchandise just yet.
Buy with confidence from a trusted seller. See my feedback. We don't trust you, you're f***ing cheap.
Yeah, season 17 was one of the casualties of the BBC social media blackout, wasn't it? Because when the trailer dropped in the morning... Season 17 was trending in the UK. And then along came the BBC to disconnect all their social media accounts. And suddenly that and the new trailer starring David Goodison, suddenly you couldn't see it anymore. It had gone. I even tried to click on a link to take you to a place where you could order the box set and it wouldn't work because it was connected to the social media account. So
it all seemed a rather bizarre idea, didn't it?
Yes, funny old timing.
It's the fourth Tom Baker set that they've released as well, isn't it? So we're over halfway now with his series. I can't wait. I mean, I'll see your season 17, Mark, and I'll raise you season 13, which for Doc and anyone else out there who doesn't know is Terror of the Zygons through to the Seeds of Doom. That will be the one when I will literally be camping outside the shop at night in a sleeping bag, right outside the front, waiting for it to open so I can run in and buy that slipcase.
Oh, yeah, it's a brilliant season.
Yeah, the slipcases are sold in HMV and Zavvi and where have you, so they're more sort of a general sale. So I'll, when that comes out for season 13, it will be my season 17 moment that Mark's got there.
You see, that B&M manager, he's actually a twat in a way, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, he sold all those Doctor Who boxes, but that's one person turning up, putting them in his truck and driving away. Let's say, I don't know, he takes away 100 boxes. If that hadn't happened, and then obviously I always assume they all sell, there's 100 people, different people coming into the store, wandering around the store to find it. Just seems, and you also, I mean, this is, I'm not suggesting for 1 minute, but with that sort of thing, you often wonder if there's something going on behind the scenes.
A little backhander.
Yeah, a little douceur for the manager. Yeah, for this to happen. I decided that douceur sounds more sophisticated. But what's interesting is that presumably B&M release all these on the same day, don't they? So whoever these people are, they can't turn up to every B&M store when they open. So if the scalpers can't physically be the first in the queue in every store at once, it suggests that it would need some sort of pre-arrangement with the store behind the scenes. So if they can order ahead.
Yeah, because I mean, those are literally the only things that I go into B&M for, to go and look and see what Doctor Who figure sets they've got left. So, and I do buy the stuff when I go in there, but now that I know that they're not there, I didn't bother. I mean, I was going past there today and I would have gone in if I'd thought they had any, but knowing that they'd sold them all already, I didn't bother.
No.
I think we'll publicise our condemnation of B&M on this podcast on Twitter, I think, and also we'll see if we could accidentally tag B&M Canterbury in on it. But I seriously think that the only thing to do is for fans just to say we're not going to buy any of this stuff off Skype until...
Off eBay.
off Skype. off eBay until this sort of thing stops happening.
Yeah.
I mean, doubling the price. Bloody shit talks.
John Richardson once said of B&M that it's like...
You're going to have to tell Jimmy what B&M is.
What's B&M?
It's one of the leading variety stores in the country.
The variety store?
It's a bit like if B&Q Homebase screwed Poundland.
I'm sorry, you go there every Sunday?
We don't go on a Sunday.
We do.
It's too busy on a Sunday. We go on a Monday.
And you say to me, don't you? You say, you can have any tea towel you want.
If you shop at B&M, you can't help but believe that there is a Jesus. Because some of the bargains there. You can get 10 kilograms of kiln-dried birchwood, right, for £6.99. That's incredible.
In the same shop, you can get... You know those big jars of pickled onions that they only have in pubs or chippies? You can buy those. You don't need ID.
Jimmy, you can buy as much of a very faded sort of creamy white imperial... Cousson's imperial leather. You can literally buy more than you'll need for your life in one visit.
And still have change out of a fiver.
I was supposed to have never been in there. Seems a strange place for... Is it Character Options that are doing this? A strange place for them to do a deal with, isn't it? Because it suggests, isn't it, that Character Options don't give a toss either. They're clearly being offered a great deal before this. I don't understand if they were doing it with, Tesco or Asda or someone. Or even, you know, dividing them among several distributors, yeah. I'd never really heard of the place before. Do they have a branch in Knightsbridge?
No, that's being too snooty. Do they have a branch on Deansgate? No, I'll make it even more so that only other Mancunians can understand the full horrific implications. Do they have a branch on Tibb Street?
Not Doctor Who related, but I've had a new thing that I can add to my weird things to be scared of, which sort of runs into something which we spoke about.
Oh, that famous list.
That famous list, yeah, from about 2 years ago on our Halloween special. Are you two both a fay with the Young Ones? The 1980s alternative comedy classic show from the 80s. So, it was about 3 o'clock in the morning. I'd just woken up and put William back to sleep. And I was having trouble getting back to sleep myself, so I clicked on my phone. I had a little look on my phone, and I came across an article on Digital Spy, which said there was a shouting in its headline. There was a fifth housemate in The Young Ones. And I thought, what? No, this can't be right.
Yes, yeah.
So I clicked on the article and was reading the article and was looking at these screenshots of this ghostly figure in the background of scenes in the house in the first series, sort of lurking behind Rick Mayall and Aid Edmondson and the other two. And I'd never seen them before. Now, I mean, The Young Ones is a show I've watched for like 20 years. You know, it was one of the videos that my parents had and I'd sneakily watch when I was growing up thinking, tee-hee-hee, aren't I grown up watching this naughty comedy? And not once did I ever spot this lanky-haired, faceless, bare-armed image standing by me. And it's like something from The Ring. And I went back, and my wife went out to the gym last Wednesday, and I had William. And he's 6 months old now, which means we can leave him in the crib and I can go downstairs and, you know, just basically get on with my evening.
Effectively abandon him, Hayden.
Yeah, effectively, like I said, I haven't seen him for a while since, you know, shoving him under that fence. So I thought, well, I'm going to watch series one again. I'm going to look out for this character. So I sat down to watch series one. And obviously it's very dark at night again, isn't it? And and the moment when this figure pops up for the first time on screen in the first episode, sitting behind, it's when Rick sits down to watch the youth television. This figure's behind him. At that point, William decided to emit this piercing cry through the baby monitor, made me jump out of my skin, nearly went through the roof, and ever since then, I'm now terrified of The Young Ones. So you can add that to all my other things, like You're Never Alone with a Swan, the Tango advert, the Spirit of Dark and Lonely Water, and Marty Feldman, with all the things I'm terrified of.
Oh, and Specials Ghost Town.
What did he cry through the baby monitor? Was it, Dad? Stop paying attention to your own childhood and pay some attention to mine.
Well, he was supposed to be asleep, Doc, but how wrong I was.
When did we do a Halloween episode?
I think it was 2 years ago now, I think.
Podcast records. I'm going to guess it would be round about the end of October, do you think?
Yeah, it must have been.
Oh, I'm a card, aren't I? Kickboxing on the Wreck.
Sounds familiar.
You're Never Alone with a Swan. Oh, here we are. You're Never Alone with a Swan. Oh, this is where we exercised Mark from his doing his
Jodie Whittaker Wears Socks
and
Holes.
Oh, yes.
Thing in his bedroom. That was a sketch and a half, wasn't it?
That was.
They don't make them like they used to.
No, we've had lots of congratulations from you, faithless listeners, since our prize appearance on University Challenge recently. Mark, Hayden and I and Uncle Terence appeared as representing Diddley-Dum College, of which we are all alumni. And it didn't go too badly, did it? We thought we'd provide you with a quick audio clip from it, for those of you who haven't heard it yet.
University Challenge. Asking the questions, Jeremy Paxman.
Let's just get on with it then. Fingers on the buzzers. Here's your first starter for 10. Rose, tulip, cedar, velvet and green can all, in political history, precede what term?
Diddly dum dicks.
The revolution.
Revolution is correct. Right, your bonuses are on quotations from English literature. Each answer is a word that is represented in the acronym TARDIS, as in Doctor Who. What is the first word of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby and the seventh word of Orwell's 1984?
Oh, I think I might know this. I read a book once, it was a green one.
Oh, excuse me, it was great work. Was it Bascoric or Valavatorius at all, was it?
Oh, yeah, say that, go with that.
That's good.
It's got an R in it, hasn't it?
It's the answer, David Tennant. The answer is always David Tennant, isn't it, with Doctor Who?
I think you might be right with that, because they might think... I bet they'll think we wouldn't be clever enough to get Rex Cook of Halbertorius.
Come on, let's have it, please.
Yes,
get our captain, Uncle Terence, to answer that.
Is it Rex Cook of Halbertorius?
No, it's in. What does Shakespeare describe as devouring and wasted in the opening lines of his sonnets... number 19 and 106, respectively.
Oh, I'm not sure. This is the book I read.
Yeah.
Okay, let's say that.
Devouring and wasted.
Is it time?
That is time, yes.
Well done.
Finally, what is the fourth word of John Keats's Ode to Autumn?
Oh, no, definitely.
Oh, it's a bit awkward. It was good.
Relative.
Could it be
space?
Could
be space.
Come on, let's have it, please.
I think it might be time, chaps.
Yeah, it's time. We just had time.
Season of mists and relative dimensions.
So do you think it's and?
Oh, well done. Well done. Go for that, Uncle Terence.
Is it and?
And is correct, yes.
Unfortunately, as well as we did, we eventually ended up getting knocked out by Extra Comprehensive. Now, what we're doing on this podcast, Faithlessness, as I haven't got round to it, is we are reviewing Evil of the Daleks, primarily because the DVD Blu-ray came out last month. Now, you may have noticed in our most recent podcast, Faith Assistance, where we talked about the TV movie and Night of the Doctor, that for the first time, when we introduced it, I gave a very brief précis of each story. That's because, as you may be aware, my mother listens to the podcast these days, and she knows absolutely nothing about Doctor Who. So when I say to her, so what did you think about what we said about, for example, Terror of the Zygons? She says, oh, I never understand a word of that. I only listen because I like listening to you and your friends chatting together. And I thought, friends? We haven't had a guest on for months, have we? And then I thought, oh, maybe she's thinking of the three of us. I think we'd better allow her to keep her illusions. And so what I'm going to start doing is, so she can at least attempt to grasp the crux of what we're talking about, I'm going to start giving very, very brief introductions. So, for example, Evil of the Daleks. This was broadcast in 1967, and it was the final story of Patrick Troughton's first season as the Second Doctor. Famously, these story tapes were wiped from the BBC archives in the late 1960s, and only episode 2 remains, in the form of a telerecording found at a car boot sale. Someone clearly needed a car boot. Which was returned to the BBC archives in 1987. All of the missing episodes have now been animated, and the whole story got released as a DVD Blu-ray last month. Obviously, the only way any of us would have known about this story prior to this coming out recently was either if we'd watched one of the Loose Cannon reconstructions, or if we'd just listened to the audio soundtrack, or if we'd read the novelisation. Personally, I'd done none of them. I also only got about halfway through the surviving episode 2 a long time ago before I nodded off. Had any of you bothered to listen to it? Or to listen watch before?
I have previously watched the Loose Cannon reconstruction, and that was during I watched all of Hartnell and Troughton all in a row. And I watched every single reconstruction a few years ago. And I remember at the time, this was pre-Power of the Daleks animation as well. And so I watched a reconstruction of that. And I remember thinking that at the time that Power of the Daleks was by far the better story. And I kind of liked Evil of the Daleks quite a bit because it was quite weird. But at the same time, I still found it a drag over, especially through those middle episodes, particularly episodes 3 and 4 and some of 5 as well. So that was my previous thing. Also, I did have the tape cassette of Evil of the Daleks as well, but I lost it before I could finish listening to it, sadly.
Not 8-track.
On the old 8-track, I was listening to it in the old Cortina. What about you, Hayden?
Oh, well, it's one of the stories that I was aware of really early on in my fandom with Doctor Who, because DWM issue number 242, which was my first ever DWM, had the 6th episode in the Telesnap archive. So there was a mystique and this kind of weird enigma about what the evil of the Daleks was from that. And I think the story was also included in the article 20 scenes that make you realise you're watching the greatest show of all time or something like that, it was called. And I think that was elsewhere in the same issue. And I found it really intriguing. Also because that's the episode where you have the crossover from Victorian times to Skaro, isn't it? Because that's when the story jumps to arguably its best part of it, to be honest with you. But anyway, and then I remember when the Lost in Time DVD box set came out, Evil was one of the first parts I remember watching because I wanted to know what happened. And having seen the model shots and the behind-the-scenes footage of the final confrontation with the Dalek Emperor and the Black Daleks and everything else, that like the original 8mm footage with the little figures that they were doing like stop animation with the Louis Marx Dalek toys.
Oh, the Rulikins.
That's it, yeah. So I remember seeing that too, and that was on the Missing Years video that was came out with the Ice Warriors a few years earlier. So there's all this, like, it was like this jigsaw that I was slowly putting together. And then I remember when I started buying the audio collection, which was basically the audio tracks, the surviving episodes. I remember buying that around the time I got my first car. So I used to zoom around listening to that, and I used to love listening to Evil, especially late at night when I was coming back from a party, or I was coming back from dropping like an ex off or whatever, you know, like Evil was always in the car. So I suppose it's always had a special place in my heart, I guess, because it's been one of those stories that I've wanted to see, but one of those that I've just, until now, I've never been able to see.
I always thought people in the 90s or whenever it was used to listen to KLF The White Room album after a party to like come down and chill out. But you put on Evil of the Daleks.
Yeah, because I wanted the paranoia of the night before to continue. I wanted this big booming voice saying, do not fight in here, over and over again in my car. So,
to be fair, I do think there's some great music in this story. I think it's one of my favourite Dudley Simpson scores.
Yeah, I've always had a soft spot for Evil of the Daleks. So what did we think? This is what we want to know. What did we think to the story?
I mean, I think the story's really good. I think perhaps it's a bit too long. Like I said, it does. I think Jamie's trials, those are the period for me. I remember when I was, like I said before, when I was watching the photo recon, it really dragged in the photo recon. And it wasn't massively better here for me. It was the moment when I started thinking, oh, I'm going to have to take a break. There's no way I can watch all this in one sitting. But the story starts off at a cracking pace. You're straight into the plot immediately with the TARDIS being stolen on the back of a lorry and disappearing off with the Doctor and Jamie chasing after it. And then not only that, but you're very quickly into the mystery of, hold on, these people already know about the Doctor. And then shortly after that, you find out not only do they already know about the Doctor, they also know about Jamie. They've got photographs of them. I think that's brilliant. It's the way it drags you in straight away with this puzzle. And then you've got, obviously, you've got the mixture of the past and the present and the future. and this is all in the first episode. It's just a great first episode. I love it. But like I say, it does sort of drag, doesn't it?
Well, actually, I don't think it does. And the reason why I don't think it does is because it's almost split into three parts, this. You've got contemporary 60s London for the first, what, 1.5 parts of the story. And then you've got Canterbury during the Victorian era for, I'm going to have to get my maths right now, 4.5 episodes. And then you've got Scarrow for 1.5 after that. So really, it's a story of three parts. And that's the way I've always seen it, really. But I would have to agree with you. The Jamie's trial drags the story down a bit because it's just so... I mean, God, that sword fight. Listening to the audio back in the day. I used to clock up miles and that sword fight was still going on.
I was watching this earlier this week and the sword fight was going on. And I was looking at my watch thinking, I don't know I'm watching these days. I was looking at the clock thinking, this is dragging on a bit, isn't it? And I actually nodded off. And when I woke up, the sword fight was still going on.
You are kidding.
You see, I think the problem is that... there's only so much you can do with animation, isn't there? I mean, I think the animation of this is... I haven't seen the animation to The Web of Planet, but I have seen the animation to The Ice Warriors. And Web Planet. I have seen The Ice Warriors, and this is by far much, much better than it, but you've still got the case where... I don't think Jamie looks like Jamie at all, other than the fact he's wearing a kilt. I don't think you necessarily know it's Jamie.
It is interesting how with all these animations, with all these different production companies carrying out these animations, it is interesting how no one can get a really good likeness of the companions, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm. No, I mean, I think in this as well, Patrick Troughton's face, he seems to be doing his own, the changing face of Doctor Who during a lot of it, doesn't he?
He is a bit. The moment when he's possessed in episode 7, you've got Maxtables wild-eyed and looking hypnotised, whilst Troughton just looks hungover. His eyes go almost a little bit sort of squinted.
You see, what doesn't help for me is that I find the Daleks boring beyond belief these days. I did it when I was little, obviously, but unless they're done really well in something like Dalek by Robert Sherman?
Yeah.
Or something like that. The habit of repeating words ad infinitum, like exterminate, 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 and you just think, just stop it, bores me. I don't think they... You see, it's hard to make them look scary once you pass childhood. It's hard to make them look scary at all. But I think it's impossible to make them look scary in that sort of animation, because they... You see... I've always thought that Power of the Daleks and Eva of the Daleks, which are at the beginning and the end of this this year's series, Patrick Troughton, very similar. Apart from one episode of Evil, all the episodes were lost. And there were two Dalek stories that everyone thought, a bit like Tomb of the Cybermen, aren't they? Oh, what would be amazing if they came back. But we went to the BFI release of the Power DVD, didn't we, Hayden, you and I?
Yes, we did, yeah.
And I've seen this, and I've still not watched more than... I don't think I've even watched the full first episode of Power yet, because it was just boring me to tears. I mean, seriously.
See, I find that odd, because I find that these two Dalek stories are excellent. I think they finally... Because they haven't got Terry Nation writing them at all. He's got nothing to do with them, really. These are two of the most interesting Dalek stories. I think they do really different stuff with them, both in Power and especially with this one, Evil. I think it's really... I mean, the plot's slightly bonkers, but, I mean, it's kind of...
Well, that stuff about the mirrors.
Yeah, it's kind of Cyberman levels of plotting, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, bizarre plots by the baddies. But no, I totally disagreed. Even when I watched the photo recon of Power of the Daleks, I thought the quality of the story And the newness it brought to the Daleks, for me, really shone through. So I find it really odd that you'd find them boring.
That's possibly my problem, that I just really need to punch myself in the face and stick with it. And I'm going to get into it. Because at the moment, I have not the faintest idea what the plot of Power of the Daleks is, other than that the Doctor lands on some deserted asteroid other than this colony that's there. And they've found a crashed spaceship that we're vaguely aware that there are Daleks inside. So I've not got past that yet. And maybe it's if I just kick myself off. Because one of my favourite Dalek scenes is the whole, you know, going round and round saying Daleks conquer and destroy thing. I still haven't got to that. And there's some amazing stuff in the last couple of episodes of this with the Emperor Dalek.
Mm.
But I think, you see, I quite like the first episode where you've got the sort of segues from the end of the Faceless Ones, isn't it, where they're both chasing this truck that's driving the TARDIS away with the on the back of the truck. And I thought that start was quite invasion-y.
Yes.
Mm. In that they're on modern-day Earth, meeting various humans who are clearly up to no good, and discovering a series of little mysteries, which, because it's not, oh, here's a mystery that's going on some distant planet with strange, you know, in a strange forest or with strange alien creatures. But it's actually on Earth with people playing humans. It makes it nicely interesting, that.
Mm.
And then you're meeting, I think there's a problem with the fact that the various people who are the sidekicks of Waterfield, there's at least three or four of them. I very quickly got confused as to who was who. Particularly when the lesser characters, the animation isn't, the faces isn't exactly, they don't go to exactly to town on it. And I thought that was going really well. I think one of the big problems, this isn't something that's interested me, it's only mildly, it's a pity, as always in Dalek stories, that one of the best potential breadwinners for a Dalek story always gets ruined by the fact that they include the Daleks in the story title. At least in something like The Invasion, it was a surprise that it was the Cybermen who were behind everything. They didn't spoil it by calling it The Invasion of the Cybermen. Now, just think how amazing that Dalek materialising at the end of episode one would have been.
Mm.
Or had we not known already, when Waterfield's talking about his patrons, there's no mystery there, we know who they're going to be, because the story is called Evil of the Daleks. Possibly the Dalek appearing in the spray paint at the end of episode one of Plans of the Daleks is a similar sort of thing, except the fact that he's already met some Thals pretty much suggests who there's going to be.
I was going to say, every Dalek story's episode one ends with the Dalek reveal at the end of episode one, doesn't it? So they're all written as if the Daleks are the...
Which is purposeless, yeah.
Surprise thing, but they can't resist putting Daleks in the title.
Now, unless these spoiler titles were something that Terry Nation insisted on, presumably they were used to attract a bigger audience. And I wonder if anyone's ever checked to see whether the first episodes of Dalek stories actually did attract higher audiences than the average.
Actually, I've got my Doctor Who yearbook to hand, so I can tell you. Hang on a moment. So the Daleks got 9 million after Unearthly Child got 5.9. Dalek Invasion of Earth got 11.9 million after Planet of Giants got 8.6. So it's looking good so far. Mission to the Unknown got 8.3 after, get this, Doc, Galaxy 4 got 9.9.
Ah, but Mission to the Unknown doesn't have Daleks in the title.
Well, that's true. That's true. And then the Dalek's Master Plan. Well, all of these had single titles anyway, didn't they? During Hartnell's era until the very end. Mm. Dalek's Master Plan got 9.3 when the Mythmakers got 8.3. Let's go on to season 4. Ooh, yeah, it's working so far. Power of the Daleks, 7.8 over the 10th Planet, which got 6.8. Ooh, get this. So the Evil of the Daleks got 6.4 million after the Faceless Ones got 7.4.
Oh.
So that's interesting.
What was 6.4 million?
Evil.
Evil of the Daleks.
I found it said 8.1 million.
Well, I'm looking through the Doctor Who yearbook, unless things changed, I don't know.
Evil of the Daleks, episode 1, 8.1 million.
Oh, okay.
Having said that, my figures come from Wikipedia, and if they're done by the same person who was speaking about cannabis spliffs...
Yes.
So what was that figure you got? 6 points?
6.4 I got.
First episode of Power was 6.9 million. First episode of Highlands is 6.7. First episode of Underwater Menace, 8.3. Moonbase, 8.1. Macroterra, 8 million. Faceless Ones, 8 million. Evil, 8.1. So there were actually only... So it's a great boost. But just spoils it for me, and really, and it's something that could really boost that story. But once that Dalek reveal happens, almost until they end up on Skaro, I'm just sitting there twiddling my thumbs, bored to tears. There's far too much outrageous padding. I don't know why Terrell exists in the story. I don't know why he and Windsor Davis tried to kidnap Jamie briefly. That's even explained.
Yeah, it's a bit odd, that bit.
And I'm hearing them describing it in some of the commentaries as, oh, the great lost epic story. And I'm thinking, well, apart from possibly the final two episodes, is it?
Aren't the five episodes before that setting up, you know, we've already said about there's the mystery there. You know, are they not just, I don't know, just like, the way I see it is that it's kind of...
The mystery of...
Well, the mystery of how these people know who the Doctor is, where the Daleks fit into things, what is the overall plan, what is the test that Jamie's... It feels as though it's posing several questions, which are answered slowly over the period of the seven episodes, I thought. I mean, there's the revelation at the end of episode 6 that they didn't want the Doctor to find the human factor. They wanted to... Well, they didn't want him to find the human factor to destroy the human factor. They wanted to find the human factor to work out how to best it with the Dalek factor, which I thought was a clever twist. Yeah, I know what you mean, though. I don't think it's perfect.
Also, I don't think it helps that I find that the characters of Edward Waterfield and Maxtable it's like watching paint dry under the animation. Now, when you see that Maxtable is played by the amazing Marius Goring, who's actually a famous film star, big character in A Matter of Life and Death, one of my joint favourite film. But in that beard, and I'm talking about the surviving episode, he's almost unrecognisable. His voice is certainly unrecognisable.
Yeah.
And he's just putting on this sort of mock Victorian, sort of very heavy voice. And there's just, I just don't find any interest in it. You know, coming up, I was going to say, we really have to start reviewing a story that I really like, because the listeners must be thinking, God, why doesn't he just stop doing the podcast if Doctor Who depresses him so much?
But this is the thing, Doc, is that we have chosen stories that we thought that you'd like, and you still haven't liked them.
Also, don't worry, Doc, because the new series of Doctor Who starts soon.
Oh, Jodie's new series is coming up. Oh, brilliant. Oh, that'll be good.
That'll pick you up. That'll be an absolute tonic for you.
Which stories did you choose you thought I'd like?
Okay, so recently we've done Day of the Doctor, which you really didn't like. We did the Seventh Doctor era, which you really detested.
Effectively, unless you choose a Third Doctor, Fourth Doctor, or Ninth Doctor story, I'm probably going to be... You see, you're always left with thinking, if this could have been amazing if we actually had the actual film left. You've got some lovely business between the Doctor and Jamie, like, you know, the jammed warehouse door where the Doctor just opens it inwards and Jamie was trying to push it outwards. And you've got the Doctor in the shop telling Jamie not to knock anything over, and then Jamie following him behind and stopping the Doctor knocking over all this porcelain.
That's actually one of the things, isn't it? When you watch the actual episode 2, the surviving episode, after you've watched the animation, you suddenly realise how many corners they've cut and how much of the personality of the actors that you're actually losing. Because when you're talking about some of the business that they do in the antique shop with the Patrick Troughton walking past and, you know, say, don't knock, don't break anything, Jamie, and then almost knocking off that porcelain figure and Jamie having to catch it.
Yeah.
The chemistry between them and the charm is much greater, obviously.
Imagine if they'd never rediscovered Tune, they'd animated that. And all we had of the Doctor and Jamie holding hands in the first episode, discovering that they're holding hands, was just the animation of it. How no one would probably think that was anything in the slight. There might have been, you know, an anecdote somewhere where Fraser says, oh, and what happened? We did this little business. But it's a pity that you can't see that little bit of business we did where we held hands together. And maybe, as it was probably an ad lib between the two of them, it may well not have even been in the animation if no one knew about it. So that points out problems with the animation.
Despite the lag in the middle of the story, it really does pick up once you get towards the end of episode 5, I think. I mean, the first sight of Dalek friends is just it's wonderful. That's love bizarre, them. I love their voices. I love Dalek say, eto.
What I think is interesting there is they clearly were intending to the last minute to get rid of them, weren't they? Because after that whole Dizzy Doctor thing and riding on the like trains, you would have thought it would be difficult for anyone to take them seriously again, wouldn't you? They were clearly, you know, having some fun at their expense until they Terry Nation apparently changed his mind at the last minute and says, I've decided I want to write some more Dalek stories, so please don't kill them off.
Well, one of my problems with the story, I think, is it's quite an obvious one. The character of Kemmel, for several reasons, other than the fact that it's rather a lazy trope of the manservant person of...
It's very Toberman, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. It's Toberman. And also, I mean, because it's lovely, because his budding bromance with Jamie is really enjoyable, and it's a lovely part of the story. And Kemmel's great all the way through it, but you just know he's doomed. It's almost as soon as he turns up, he's big, he's silent, and he's good-hearted. And I think we were watching a Sweeney last night, weren't we, Doc?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Where there was a character who was played by the chap who was Kane in Dragonfire, and he played a character called Lenny, who was very much like Lenny from Of Mice and Men.
Mm.
He was a big bloke, a bit simple, but basically good-hearted, except for the fact that he was being manipulated by a baddie.
A bit like me.
And you knew that he was going to die before the end of the story, didn't you? And he did.
Yeah.
And it's the same with Kemmel. And it was the same with Barnum as well in Mind of Evil. When Barnum, who's that big convict who has all the evil drained out of him, just becomes a big, lovely teddy bear of a man. And for no reason at the end, these people always die. And it just kind of makes me angry as well, especially when it's such a pointless death. I mean, it's hard to know what it would have actually looked like, but just in the animation, just Maxtable just sort of like going at him on the edge of a cliff and him falling off. It's just, annoys me.
I was quite shocked that it happened.
You were?
Yeah, but I didn't see that coming.
I mean, like the death of Barnum in Mind of Evil as well, absolutely pointless. It infuriated me when I was watching it a little while ago with Polly, and just one of the pointless deaths in Doctor Who that makes me angry, and Kemmel's was another.
I wonder if they're saying killing someone off would be an easy way to get some tension to the story, wouldn't it? Why not kill someone who never speaks anyway? No, I'm not being sarcastic. I wonder if that's seriously what they thought.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, maybe. But, I mean, they've already killed off Waterfield. Waterfield had a really good noble death. Yeah. As well, didn't he? And what was his last line? So, a good life to save, he said to the Doctor after he'd saved his life. You know, that was poetic and noble, not just tumbling backwards off a cliff. I don't know, maybe it looked better in the original story.
There's that scene, isn't there, with Victoria and the Doctor at the start of episode 7, when she says, oh, what's eating you, to the Doctor, and he's saying, I'm just wondering how I'm going to get 5 people home. And I thought to myself, you don't need to worry, Doctor. You've only got one by the end of the episode.
They were just completely, they're whittled down, aren't they, by the end of it?
Yeah.
There was a really good theory I saw once on one of the DVD documentaries about the Daleks, that when the Daleks turn up, bad things happen. Either a companion leaves or a doctor. There's events that go forward. And I think it's really interesting. And they could do so much with this now, with the more sort of character depth that they put into things with the show nowadays. For the Doctor to effectively pick up an orphan and the Daleks have killed her father, you could do some really good stuff. I know we have that scene in Tomb, but apart from that, really, yes, there's nothing after that about Victoria. And it wasn't a consideration for a show that was only going to be seen once, you know, effectively in the 60s, and that was it.
Mm.
But I've always found it's what happens when the Daleks turn up. There is bloodshed. There's collateral damage. Every time you look at Dalek Invasion of Earth, when they return, Susan leaves. When they come back in the chase, Ian and Barbara leave. When they come back in the Dalek Master Plan, Sarah Kingdom and Katarina are killed, and the Time Destructor is set off.
Brett Vile.
And Brett Vian, yeah, and Power of the Daleks, you know, half the colony is wiped out. And then with Evil here, the whole of Skaro is pretty much destroyed for the first time in the show's canon. Oh, it'll be destroyed again, don't you worry.
But not the last.
And I've always looked at it like that. I've always thought anyone walking into a Dalek story that isn't a companion are going to be dead by the end of it. I've always thought that with Dalek stories. Always.
Yeah, I mean, Maxtable had to die because he was morally bankrupt, wasn't he? He'd done everything for greed. He'd put people's lives at risk. He was obviously never going to survive.
No. I never thought Kemble was going to survive. I didn't think Waterfield was ever going to survive. I mean, Waterfield was spoilt for me when I read it I think it was in the Tomb of the Cybermen novelisation, actually. I think it said right at the very... Yeah, it would be, because this follows on from Evil, doesn't it? So, yeah, I know what you mean, though. I think, yeah, again, it's a character not being very well serviced.
I'm not being serviced!
It's interesting that there was a... Did you notice they put in a surviving Dalek at the end of this? Which I presume wasn't in the original as well.
It was the Emperor.
No, it wasn't the Emperor, was it? It was...
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Was it?
In the original, it's they put a light bulb, Timothy Coombe... was working on the show, and they put a light bulb in the Emperor, because right at the very last second, somebody said, oh no, don't destroy the Daleks.
That's Terrination, yeah.
Oh, but everything's been rigged to blow. And they said, well, what can we do at the last minute? They said, well, we'll just have a little bulb flickering inside the Emperor Dalek shell. And that's what they did. But in this, it's a Dalek's eye stalk lights up, doesn't it, at the very end?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Terry Nation had tried to flog the Daleks to America and they weren't interested. And he sort of lost interest himself, and I think he said, I'll just kill them off. I'm not interested in doing any more stuff for them. Then at the end, as they were completing Evil, he suddenly changed his mind and said, oh, don't kill them off, I want to write some more Dalek stories. Which is why they needed to have show that one of them was surviving at the end.
Which is very interesting that he says, oh no, I want to do more Dalek stories. They don't do another one until 1972. And he doesn't even write that one. He writes Planet of the Daleks in 73. So, yeah, it's interesting.
But the Emperor's on probably the best thing in it for me.
Oh, brilliant.
The voice is extraordinary. Who's doing the voice?
I think all the Dalek voices in this story are great, including the ones who are going, why?
There's that moment. When the Black Dalek does the, who spoke? questions the Dalek Commander, and it goes really out of its shell. Yeah. The car you operate whenever the Emperor Dalek spoke, I seem to remember.
Did you have your big bass speakers
in
the suit?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. Can you imagine me driving along a little village and someone's got, this is your Emperor speaking, do not a
little Bumstead.
Here. Yeah, going through Steeple Bumstead, and you've got me with my cap on the wrong way round, leaning out the window.
With a gangster lean out the side of the car.
Yeah.
Perhaps that's what we could rename ourselves as podcasters. The bass speakers. So who's in it? Let's pass over Deborah Watling.
Oh, I think Deborah Watling's all right in this. I think she's quite good.
Oh, you don't?
Yeah, I think she's... Well, I think at the start she certainly is.
That dreadful artificial sobbing that would become familiar to us.
God, bloody hell.
I did used to have a massive crush on Victoria, though. I remember when I first saw her in Doctor Who Weekly and then Monthly in old photos from the old series. I just think, oh, she's rather nice. So maybe I'm biased.
I think she's all right here, but there's not much of her in this story, is there?
No.
Yeah, it's interesting because they give her an intro. They give her a good premise of being prisoner of the Daleks. And then once she's rescued, there's not really much else for her to do apart from become orphaned at the end of the story.
No, true.
We've got John Bailey, who plays Waterfield. He was in the Sense Rites. God knows what he played. They're all the same, don't they? Mark appears as Sesam in Horns of Nyman.
Ugh.
Alec Ross. Who was Bob Hall? One of the nobodies in the first episode, wasn't he?
Yes,
he was. Played by Alec Ross, who was Sheila Hancock's first husband before John Thor. Joe Robottom played Molly Dawson, I think it's the maid. Yes. She was Calpurnia in I, Claudius. Claudius's prostitute girlfriend. Of course, Bridget Forsyth playing Ruth Maxtable, she was famously in The Likely Lads as Thelma. And Windsor Davis is obviously in many things. Sonny Caldinas was in Ice Warriors, Caesar, well, effectively anything that requires an Ice Warrior in it. So you pictured Cassim as this mute strongman, though, and I don't know whether it was done subconsciously, but he looks, in this animation, so extraordinary like the character of Rasim the Strong, who was the strongman from the Arabian Nights cartoon that used to be part of the Banana Split show. a tall muscle man with brief costume and fez. That's essentially. Now, the Arabian Nights used to be really good. Did you used to watch the Banana Splits, Mark?
Oh, yeah. That was Saturday. Well, no, it wasn't just Saturday mornings, was it? It was summer holiday viewing, wasn't it?
Summer holiday mornings, that's right, wasn't it?
Yeah, with the monkeys as well, and Batman.
Oh dear! What was the magician called? Farik, wasn't it? Little fat magician who used his magic words were what was that? Rosan Kabar. He's cast a spell on someone, and the donkey that they pulled its tail and it turned into a whirlwind. Bez. A dark-skinned man with a turban and green clothing who used to dance on the stage with Happy Mondays. Who would say, size of a insert name of an animal here, and he would turn into a... I don't know if he ever did size of a donkey. Perhaps that would have been a bit... It's such a pity that they lost it. They must have gone so much expense to film it all at Grimm's Dyke, which I've actually been to. God knows where that's somewhere. It's somewhere out past Harrow, I think. Do you know Phil Newman, Hayden?
I do, yeah.
I vaguely remembered him from one of the interviews you did. How do you know him?
Blimey. Just from sort of conventions going back several years. I haven't spoken to him for ages, actually. But he's good egg, his old Phil.
He was interviewing Chris Thompson. In Grimm's Dyke, that was where Gilbert lived, of Gilbert and Sullivan. And died trying to save a young girl from drowning in the lake he'd built on the property. Gilbert and Sullivan. How would that go for us? We are the very model of a fourth-rate Doctor Who podcast. Derek Martinez was quite good. There was an interview on the disc with him and Richard Marston. He sounds fun. And he only needs a jolt of his memory to remind him of quite a stuff. I didn't have no idea that Ray Kuzik used to call Verity Lambert Variety Lamppost. Which I found mildly amusing.
Poor old Lamppost.
I'm quite shocked when the Doctor pushed Omega over the edge.
Oh, yeah, so was I at first. I hadn't realised that he'd clocked that it was traitor. That was yeah, quite shocking.
No.
Especially as I'd completely fallen in love with them.
And it is a pity that the one scene that we've not got is Jamie falling out with the Doctor.
Yeah.
So, you know, I finished with you. Yeah, that could have been interesting to see that actually acted out by the two actors.
I think that's a lot of the problems with the animation, is the fact that I did spend an awful, awful lot of time trying to picture in my head what the original broadcast would have looked like. And that's still an itch that the animation can't scratch for me. I know that there's bits we're missing, and I'm just, yeah, it's still frustrated that it's it's a missing episode, and the animation, as good as it is, doesn't quite do it for me. Hayden wanted to say something about the animation, didn't you?
Yeah, when the BFI showing of this came out, was it about a fortnight before the actual Blu-ray did, a lot of people were coming out there saying, oh, this is the best animation that they've done so far. Oh, isn't it fantastic? Finally, they've given a production studio enough time to get it looking just so and all the rest of it. And I thought, oh dear, I really hope I don't put this in and then I'm disappointed because it's been overhyped. Much in the way that The Web of Fear was completely condemned, wasn't it, after that one came out. I thought, oh no,
yeah,
they've already destroyed my beloved Web of Fear. And what are they going to do to another beloved story of mine, The Evil of the Daleks? And it was fantastic. I really, really enjoyed the animation. In fact, I rewatched episode 7 last night and just absolutely marvelled at how brilliant, especially the Dalek Emperor, the final end, the showdown, looked fantastic. Absolutely brilliant. I've been watching recently Marvel's What If series, which is something weird. I mean, the animation's very fluid. It's almost this sort of Web of Fear done right, basically, with the whole motion capture thing. Really advanced. And I would say the Dalek scenes in this were up there with that. They were astonishing. Absolutely brilliant. And I really do think, I mean, I think this and Macra are the best two that we've had so far, certainly.
Yeah, I think I'd agree. With regards to the Daleks, the animation of the Daleks, I have to say that since we... Do you remember when we watched Power? Basically, the best bit in that was the animation of the Daleks then. I think it's something they nailed very early on, and it's presumably once you've got the models and the dimensions and things sorted for that, it's easier because you're not trying to do human movement. They can just glide around. You know, you don't have to put emotion on their faces. I just think they've nailed the Daleks, and they look beautiful in this. And the explosions, yeah, that final scene, the explosions looked brilliant as well. They had the animation of those, excellent. And I even enjoyed seeing inside the Dalek casings as well, and seeing the little green Dalek creatures. Absolutely gorgeous, that bit. And the light effects as well on this, I think, are some of the best we've seen, which is one of the reasons I think why the Emperor Dalek looks so good. But even bits when they're walking around the mansion and you've got shafts of light coming in through the windows and people walking through the shafts of light, and it just looks lovely. And the lighting effects over the door, over the arch, which they go through for the human or Dalek factor. And I just think some things like that they've really nailed. What they haven't nailed is stuff like the movement, obviously, because there's bits where the people are running and it still looks... I mean, there's no... I know they just don't have the time and money, and it must be incredibly difficult to give those sort of two-dimensional drawings the weight they need to look like they're running properly. And it looks slightly comical. It's not huge criticism, because I know that it's basically time and it's budget, isn't it? You know, so the more difficult things like that have to take a back seat. They also even had a moving camera when you first go into the lab, Max DeBoer's laboratory, and you actually get it's almost like a 3D, like a camera going into a 3D lab and moving across it. You know, the perspective changed on things and moved around. They didn't do that very often, but it looked great the time that they did do it. And I think they do a really good job. They might not quite get the likenesses properly, but I do think they do a pretty good job of conveying emotion in the faces.
I think they do. Yes, yes, they do. Yeah, there's more nuance there than there has been in the past, I'd say. No, I lapped it up. I thought this was fantastic from beginning to end. To be fair, I have done with most of the animations, unless they have been notoriously shoddy, like Web of Fear and Reign of Terror, I remember, was one I watched and kind of thought, ugh.
Yeah, Fury from the Deep, I think, was one that we were too taken with, was it? Because of that did seem, I think there was a lot more people standing around talking and doing nothing else in that.
Yes, yes.
I didn't mind it, but I knew what you both meant, yeah.
What did you make of the animation, Doc?
I'm not sure I've enjoyed any of the animations apart from Quiet Invasion.
Oh, well, yeah, that's...
But I'm not sure I've enjoyed any of the animations, but I think it's...
Did you not enjoy the Macro Terror?
Because I can't... With Doctor Who, I can't really handle the audios on their own. Because, obviously, I can handle audio plays, but audios which are not written as audio plays, which are just the audio parts of missing video, don't entertain me. Because one of the big things for me with Doctor Who is the performance and the acting. And I think that's possibly what's putting me off here. I was so disappointed with Marius Goring as Maxtable, because he's just, it seems to me, could have been anyone doing him. He had to be swathed in a big overcoat, part of the time a top hat, and an enormous bushy beard. And I wonder whether episode 2 were just unfortunate in that, you know how the only episode that was surviving of Enemy of the World was that tedious one in the bloody kitchen all the time? And you might have thought if you'd only seen that, God, program, I'm glad that story didn't survive. But I'm wondering if he gets more, you know, into it in other scenes, in other episodes. And it's just unfortunate that episode 2 is not one of his strong ones. Because I was really looking forward to seeing this. Not in animation, of course, it wouldn't have been him. But I was really looking forward to having the motivation to watch it, given that otherwise I probably wouldn't have done.
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
So marks out of 10?
Marks out of 10. I would say this is a 9 for me. I think the story gets more interesting as it goes. I loved the animation. It's a story I've always really enjoyed. It's barking in a good way for me. So thoroughly entertaining and a great way to wrap up my favourite Doctor's first season.
I have a feeling that if I could watch this, the actual original broadcast, I probably would give it a 9 because it's a story I really enjoy. I like the story a lot, but I can't stop imagining what it must look like on broadcast even whilst I'm watching the animation. So bits of the animation are really nice, but it still doesn't quite scratch the itch. I don't know, it's odd. I really enjoyed Macro Terror a lot more than I enjoyed this, and I'm not sure why. But I'd give this 7.5. So, I mean, that's still pretty not bad.
I'd give it a 6, I think.
Sorry, that shattering you just heard was my heart breaking.
Oh.
Oof.
So, is that... Oh, Uncle Terence, have you come to say goodbye to us? How have you been? You're not too dejected over the University Challenge loss, are you?
I just can't believe they didn't pay for our accommodation in the end, and we had to pay for it ourselves. I mean, I don't mind Backwater Travel Lodge, but what is the BBC coming to?
Do you have any words of wisdom for us as we leave the Faithless Sisters?
As always, all of my words of wisdom are in those little target books, so the only words I'll leave with you is don't dump bodies into the river.
Uncle Terrence, we have enemy ships in Sector 27.
Do not fight in here.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Goodbye.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydum. On Twitter at @diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. diddly-dum, the empty space that circles time.